Erev Tov, welcome back to everyone from Pesach. Nice to see everyone again. This is the Presence and the Jews, part 20. John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Baines Johnson, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz. Le'ili Nishmas Yona Ben Rabbaye Leib, Tanishmas Hatzrura, Bitzra Chaim. Well, a new decade brought a new president. Think about it. A president who brought the glitz and glamour of Hollywood to the White House. A president to embrace supply-side economics, claiming that lower taxes will generate more revenue for the government and increase personal earnings. A president who favored a robust military, who asserted American power across the world, and was a staunch anti-communist. If that reminds anyone of Ronald Reagan, it would be very accurate, but it's the introduction to our analysis of John F. Kennedy. His was a very unusual presidency, tragically cut short by his assassination, devoid of many accomplishments. Some, especially regarding civil rights, took place only after he was murdered, and probably only passed because he was murdered. Certainly Lyndon Johnson thought so. Kennedy was the last president to die in office, and the fourth overall to be assassinated while in office. It was a book written a few years ago that I read entitled JFK, Conservative by Iris Stoll, S-T-O-L-L. Very interesting book. He makes a compelling case that by today's standards, JFK would be construed as a conservative. Certainly in fiscal matters, it was his slogan, he borrowed from someone, but it was his slogan that Reagan later used. In fact, Reagan quoted Kennedy, "A rising tide lifts all boats," meaning if the economy develops, if the consumers spend, there's more money in the system, even the poor are lifted by it. And in terms of national security, certainly he was very hawkish. In the campaign of 1960, he was more hawkish than his opponent was, Richard Nixon. And the social issues that have consumed American life for the last 50 years, abortion, feminism, homosexuality, etc., were simply not issues back in JFK's day. And he was part of the mainstream of American life. The welfare state was the creation of FDR and Johnson. Kennedy was not that active in it. And his reputation, his historical reputation, fluctuates because of his tragic end, because of his promiscuity that reached dangerous levels, and because of the turmoil that followed his death. The raucousness of the 1960s did not really catch fire until 1965. Kennedy and Johnson were completely different creatures, personality, temperament, background, who did not much care for each other. Bobby Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson really hated each other. Johnson, as vice president, was kept out of almost all major decisions and bided his time. Sometimes quite bitterly, so much so that his detractors and a handful of diehard Kennedy supporters even thought he had a hand in the assassination. Unproved, of course. But remember, Kennedy had gone to Texas to shore up his support there. The Texas Democrat Party was split between two factions, and he brought Johnson along to try to heal the rift, because he knew without Texas he could not win re-election in 1964. He was accompanied by Lyndon Johnson, who was riding two cars in back of the president when he was shot. But Kennedy would transform America's relationship with Israel, move it away from the cold paternalism of Eisenhower's years, and towards the special relationship, it's a term he coined, that Israel has since enjoyed with most, but not all, most American presidents. That JFK was the one to do that is surprising, given his background and his upbringing, and perhaps even more surprising and not well known, it was LBJ's affinity for Jews going back to his childhood that made him sympathetic to Israel, a trait that was only constrained by his duplicity, his cynicism, and his political maneuverings. And I'm being charitable. Well, let's begin at the beginning. A young Patrick Kennedy came from Ireland, penniless, in the late 1840s, escaping the famous Irish potato famine. He died young, age 35, of cholera. but not before he had children, and it was his grandson, Joseph P. Kennedy, John Kennedy's father, who made a fortune in the stock market, in real estate, in insider trading, we call today, and some allege also bootlegging during Prohibition. Joe Kennedy was a committed Catholic, and as was not uncommon in those times, his belief system included a profound dislike for Jews that he would never overcome. He had Jewish friends, but a hatred for the Jewish people that colored his thinking, in a sense, ruined his public life, and in due course, guided John F. Kennedy in the opposite direction. Joe Kennedy's marriage was a merger. He married Rose Fitzgerald, the daughter of Boston Mayor John Fitzgerald, the Honey Fitz, and she was pregnant for many, many years, almost not always, but usually in consecutive years. And with the lingering sadness in their family that although Joe Kennedy was a doting father, he would suffer the loss of four children in his lifetime. And he was an awful husband who engaged in numerous affairs, many of them quite public. Now, just to give a little more background, Joe Kennedy and Franklin Roosevelt were what we'd call today frenemies. The young people use that term, meaning either friendly enemies or friends and enemies. They were rivals. And because they were rivals, didn't trust each other, FDR kept Joe Kennedy close, made him the first chair of the SEC. And in the late 1930s, he appointed Joe Kennedy ambassador to the UK. In that position, Joe Kennedy became Hitler's greatest defender in the American government. He lobbied to keep the U.S. out of World War II. He hoped for a German victory in the Battle of Britain, this you see in his writings, and he never accommodated himself to Germany's defeat. He railed constantly against the influence of Jews on FDR. Remember, many of Roosevelt's advisors were Jewish. He thought the Jews were betraying America, and he was beyond an isolationist. Joe Kennedy was deemed to be pro-German, and he always assumed that Germany would win, and that also colored his thinking. So Kennedy openly supported Neville Chamberlain's appeasement policy, and even a young JFK wrote to his father, after his father gave a pro-Chamberlain speech in Britain, that he said to his father, "Your speech seemed to be unpopular with the Jews, but considered very good by everyone who wasn't bitterly pro-fascist." When the U.S. went to war against Germany, Franklin Roosevelt abruptly fired Joe Kennedy in his office at the time. Strange coincidence, was a young congressman from Texas named Lyndon Johnson. And Joe Kennedy had nothing to do but stew in his anger and plot some revenge. And he was always raging about something. Very often, it was what he called the Jew media in the U.S. who were trying to push the world into war. Joe Kennedy did almost nothing to help Jewish refugees from Europe beyond suggesting that Britain find a place for them within the empire, and he was really unconcerned about attacks on Jews in Germany and then in Europe. His oldest son, Joe, named after him, whose fighter plane exploded while on a mission in 1944, was also an admirer of Hitler. It's strange he was in that theater. Joe Kennedy never forgave Franklin Roosevelt for it, even complaining to Truman in 1944, "Harry, what are you doing campaigning for that crippled SOB that killed my son Joe?" And that's how he saw the world. And that death of Joe Kennedy would be the first of many Kennedy tragedies, almost too many to count. It's so haunting that there are persistent rumors of a curse placed on the Kennedy family by a rabbi. I heard it in the name of Rav Herzog, who apparently, allegedly, went to Joe Kennedy at the beginning of the war and solicited his help for Jewish refugee children, and Joe Kennedy brusquely refused. And Rav Herzog said to him, "Allegedly, you will yet know what it is like to lose children." I've heard the same story in the name of two other rabbanim as well, something of that sort, but there's no real credible source for it, so you can't say it's true. But the Kennedy family themselves speak of some curse, and not necessarily from Jews. Three sons killed, one daughter greatly handicapped. another daughter killed in a plane crash in 1948. A grandson killed almost exactly 50 years after the daughter was killed. One son disgraced at Chappaquiddick, etc. The curses are almost beyond belief how one family should suffer that much. Into that family, on May 29, 1917, was born their second child, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, named, of course, for his maternal grandfather. He was handsome and athletic, less so than his older brother, Joe. John Kennedy was a rabble-rouser. He enjoyed the wealth and privilege into which he was born. He was educated in private schools, summered in Europe, that type thing, and then went to Harvard. He always suffered from illness his entire life. Colitis, back problems, other ailments. In fact, he was rejected from the army when he enlisted, when the war started, on that basis because of his back issues. But he did enlist in the Navy, became a war hero when his PT cruiser was split in two by and sunk by Japanese destroyer August 1st, 1943. All but two crew members were saved. And most of them were saved because of John Kennedy, who not only inspired them with his words, but one injured was brought to safety by JFK, who swam 3 miles with a strap of that guy's life preserver clenched between his teeth. All true. He was honored for that, rightfully so, and it became part of his legend. He parlayed that fame into election to Congress in 1946 and then to the Senate in 1952. When he ran for office, he began to distance himself from his father's Jew hatred. It wasn't always an easy sell, and Jews were wary of the Kennedys. 20 years later, Bobby Kennedy, when he ran for Senate in New York, met with Jewish leaders who were cool to him, and he complained to them, "For how long do I have to be punished for my father's views?" And there's a justice to that as well. In 1947, John Kennedy openly supported ending the U.S. embargo on weapons to Jews fighting for Jewish independence in Israel, which he claimed, I quote, deprived Jews of the opportunity to defend themselves and carve out their partition. Now, this was against the Democrat administration of Harry Truman. Already in the Senate, he advocated a robust foreign policy and was frequently critical of Truman and Eisenhower. And Truman also never liked John Kennedy and opposed his nomination in 1960. In 1952, when Kennedy defeated Henry Cabot Lodge, the sitting senator of Massachusetts, Kennedy won more than 60% of the Jewish vote in Massachusetts, which means that he had done good constituency work. He actively solicited Jewish support, and he would remind voters, I guess he can't have this on a bumper sticker, but he'd remind voters, "I'm running for the Senate and not my father." So he knew his father was an albatross, notwithstanding the fact that his father funded every campaign that he ran. And he had prominent Jews come and campaign for him. Some names we've mentioned already. Herbert Lehman, been the governor of New York. Brooklyn Congressman Manny Seller served almost 50 years in the House. Abe Ribicoff from Connecticut, a familiar name. Ribicoff has a very unique distinction. He served in Connecticut as a congressman, as a governor, as a senator, and also as JFK's Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare for more than 1 year. He's the only Jew ever to hold all four positions, in the Senate, House, a governor, and in the cabinet. And there are others as well. So JFK really was successful, for the most part, in avoiding being tainted by his father's Jew hatred. A year into his Senate run, he married Jacqueline Bouvier, 12 years his junior, and then almost died of illness. And again, part of the mystique of Kennedy. I think a half dozen times in the last 15 years of his life, he was given last rites by the Catholic Church because he was near death. Here as well, he was near death. While convalescing from spine surgery, which was exacerbated when PT-109 was sunk, he ghostwrote, we now know, Profiles in Courage. It was written by Ted Sorensen. Very fascinating book. I enjoyed it immensely. That won a Pulitzer Prize. Now, it was claimed he wrote it, but it was Sorensen who had it be announced after Sorensen died, which is not long ago, that in fact he had written it and it was reviewed by John Kennedy. Kennedy had few real accomplishments as a senator, and he was perceived as a man in a hurry, almost winning the nomination for vice president in 1956 and becoming a public figure already in the latter half of the 1950s, known for his looks, his wit, his dynamism, and his celebrity status. He even appeared on Jack Parr's Tonight Show in 1959, which politicians then almost never did. Now they live off these shows. And all this established a template that many other presidential aspirants would follow, including Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and even Ted Cruz. All of them, young men in a hurry. As president, JFK and his father set their sights on the presidency at a very early age. It was at the time considered astonishing and not a bit off-putting, even brazen, that someone so young, he was 39 when he first broached the matter. Remember, the Constitution requires that a president be at least 35 years old. He's not much older than the threshold. Someone so young had never run and won election for president. William Jennings Bryan was 36 when he lost the first of his three races, but he lost. Most presidents, as we know, were elected in their 50s. Most people dismissed his chances because of his youth and especially his Catholicism. No Catholic had ever won. Only one had run, Alfred Smith. And Catholic bashing was as widespread among Protestants as Jew hatred was among both groups. And he was also construed, again, interesting in retrospect, as insufficiently liberal. And the old FDR crowd, including Eleanor Roosevelt, had never forgiven his father for betraying FDR. But JFK felt it was his time. He said if he hadn't run in 1960, this he confided, so we only know it now, and a Democrat had won, by the time 1968 came along, he would be old news. And as is now known, JFK suffered, he felt that with the variety of illnesses and diseases that he had, including Addison's disease, which is an adrenal insufficiency, he might not be alive in 1968. So he felt that 1960 was his time, now or never. He was considered a brash upstart, running with his father's money, devoid of any accomplishment in the Senate, which he, like many then and now, found boring. But, as we know, Kennedy was very charming and extremely persistent. His main competitors were Hubert Humphrey and, again, Adlai Stevenson. Others were interested as well, including a Texas senator named Lyndon Baines Johnson. Humphrey was very popular with Jews, and he was overrun by the Kennedy machine. There were so many of them. They were big families, all his siblings. He complained in one state when numerous young and attractive Kennedys campaigned against him. Humphrey said he felt like an independent merchant competing against a chain store. It's like a mom and pop shop trying to go against Costco. That's how he felt. During the campaign, JFK addressed the Catholic issue head on in a way that served to forever weaken the informal religious test for presidential candidates, including Jews. You see how many people mention Bernie Sanders being Jewish as an impediment. He may be an impediment president, but that he's Jewish is not the reason why. In a speech in West Virginia during the primaries, Kennedy said, I quote, "Are we going to admit to the world that a Jew can be elected mayor of Dublin?" All these things had happened. "A Protestant can be chosen foreign minister of France. A Muslim can be elected to the Israeli parliament. But a Catholic cannot be president of the United States? Are we going to admit to the world, worse still, are we going to admit to ourselves that one third of the American people is forever barred from the White House?" So he didn't duck the issue. He took the issue on. In October, in the height of the presidential campaign, he addressed the issue again in Houston. And the fear was, raised by Catholics more than Jews, that he would have to take orders from the Vatican or subvert the First Amendment. I remember reading there were people who suggested he'd even build a tunnel from the White House to Rome to make it easier the Pope to get messages to him as to how to run the country. There in Houston, Kennedy said, "I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell parishioners for whom to vote, where no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference, and where no man is denied public office merely because his religion differs from the president who might appoint him or the people who might elect him. And he continued, I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish, where no public official either requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any other ecclesiastical source, where no religious body seeks to impose its will directly or indirectly upon the general populace or the public acts of its officials, and where religious liberty is so indivisible that an act against one church is treated as an act against all. And he concluded with very pointed words that really resonated in American history. For while this year it may be a Catholic against whom the finger of suspicion is pointed, in other years it has been, and it someday may be again, a Jew, or a Quaker, or a Unitarian, or a Baptist. And you all recall, it was Virginia's harassment of Baptist preachers that led Jefferson to draft the Statute of Religious Freedom in Virginia. Today I may be the victim, but tomorrow it may be you, until the whole fabric of our harmonious society is ripped at a time of great national peril. Well, it did put the issue to rest, at least in theory. His Republican opponent was the sitting vice president, sort of a lapsed Quaker, Richard Nixon, and Kennedy squeaked to victory in one of the closest elections ever, winning by roughly 110,000 votes, 49.72% Kennedy to 49.55% Nixon. Kennedy won only 23 states. Nixon won 26. Harry Byrd won. And a switch of just 50 to 60,000 votes in key states would have given Nixon the victory. And there are immediate allegations of fraud the night of the election, especially in Illinois, which Kennedy won by a mere 9,000 votes, and Texas, where Kennedy won by 46,000 votes. Note, Illinois, the Daley machine; Texas, the Johnson machine. In both places, apparently, Baruch Hashem, many deceased voters rose from the cemeteries to cast ballots for John Kennedy. Kennedy won the Jewish vote by an astounding 82% to 18% over Nixon. And to his credit, Nixon announced the very next day, knowing of the fraud, that he will not challenge the results of the election, despite the allegations. Sharp contrast to Al Gore in 2000. JFK was sworn in amid great excitement, delivering one of the most memorable inaugural addresses in history. And it pays just to read part of it. We dare not forget today that we are the heirs of that first revolution. Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike, that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans, born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed, and to which we are committed today at home and around the world. Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and success of liberty. And he ended, of course, the great peroration. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. It was a great speech. It's still stirring after all these years. It set a new tone, as did John Kennedy as well. There's never been such a contrast in age between two consecutive presidents. Eisenhower was 70 when he left office. JFK was 43 when he was sworn in, the youngest man ever to be elected president. And he projected vigor and energy despite his maladies. And as we now know in retrospect, he ruined the hat business. because he didn't wear a hat at his inauguration, stood in the cold without a hat, which defied the custom. And since his time, only people wear fedoras, Orthodox Jews, and old black Southerners. That's it. His presidency was less successful. Now, to be fair, in Robert Dallek's biography of JFK, it's titled An Unfinished Life, and indeed it was. Historians have speculated endlessly what would have been the fate of many of Kennedy's initiatives had he not been assassinated, even whether he would have won re-election in 1964. Likely, the civil rights legislation would not have passed, and Johnson explicitly tied it to JFK's legacy, so a vote against would be construed as a vote against the slain and martyred president. So briefly, what did Kennedy do? He cut income tax rates, made the top rate, I mean, it's like you shudder when you say these things, he made the top rate 70%, dropping it from 90%, and that itself stimulated the increase in revenues. He approved the failed Bay of Pigs invasion to attempt to liberate Cuba from Castro's dictatorship 55 years later. The Castros still hang on. He used the American military robustly in order to thwart communist advances. He challenged the Soviets when Soviet missiles were secretly brought to Cuba in the fall of 1962. And he increased the American military presence and participated in the intrigue in South Vietnam. And it was Kennedy in 1956 who declared, almost defying Eisenhower, that Vietnam is, I quote, the keystone to the arch, the finger in the dike. This is our offspring. We cannot abandon it. JFK apologists would have us believe that he would have pulled out U.S. troops from South Vietnam in a second term, but Bobby Kennedy, his own brother, denied that and said he would have fought the war to victory. But Vietnam did become a quagmire on the one hand, but under Kennedy and to that extent Johnson, at least for a time, it engendered the reassuring notion that the U.S. would not easily abandon its allies, something that is really lost today. All right, it was not at all simple. It surely doomed the LBJ administration. We'll get back to that in a little while. JFK, unlike his father, respected Jews and many Jewish advisors. Abe Ribicoff, I mentioned already. JFK also appointed Arthur Goldberg as the Secretary of Labor, the first time there were ever two Jews in the cabinet at the same time, and then he appointed him to the Supreme Court. Arthur Schlesinger was a foreign affairs advisor. Eugene Rostow was under Secretary of State. His brother Walt became Johnson's national security advisor. Eugene became an important figure during and after the Six-Day War. Should file this away. Zohar Latov, Eugene Rostow. It was Rostow who was a voice in the wilderness until today, claiming that Judea and Samaria are not occupied territories. They legally belong to Israel, having been won in a defensive war, and that Jewish settlements are perfectly legal. Eugene Rostow, he really is a voice in the wilderness. And JFK surrounded himself with Harvard professors as advisors. That prompted Bill Buckley to quip, and not incorrectly, I'd rather entrust the government of the United States to the first 400 people listed in the Boston telephone directory than to the faculty of Harvard University. JFK was the first president who can be described as pro-Israel. That's not to say there weren't tensions, but he reoriented American foreign policy away from what was basic neutrality with an arms embargo against Israel to what he termed, the first to use the term, the special relationship between America and Israel, first said to Foreign Minister Golda Meir, and it was JFK who began an open military alliance with Israel, as we'll see in a moment. Now, Kennedy was an early supporter of Jewish statehood in Israel in 1951. He visited Israel with his brother Bobby. They didn't really have much relationship until then because they're 8 years apart, and that gap meant they really lived separate lives, but they traveled through Israel together and both were very impressed. Kennedy spoke at a rally at Yankee Stadium to celebrate Israel's 8th anniversary in 1956, and he said, I quote, "It is time that the nations of the world, in the Middle East and elsewhere, realize that Israel is here to stay. She will not surrender, she will not retreat, we will not let her fall." It would be nice if we had another rally and some politician said the same thing today. But those sentiments were not common in the United States in the 1950s. Kennedy did lock horns with Ben-Gurion over Israel's nuclear reactor in Dimona, with Ben-Gurion asserting it was for peaceful purposes only, and the Americans justifiably skeptical. They met in New York City in May 1961. This was reported recently by the historian Rafael Madoff. Kennedy was very frustrated with Ben-Gurion, feeling he was not telling the truth. Asked directly if there's a military component to the reactor, I'm quoting now from a book by Professor Avner Cohen, author of Israel and the Bomb, as cited by Rafael Madoff. Ben-Gurion mumbled, spoke very softly. It was hard to hear him and understand what he was saying, partly due to his accent. Meaning he asked the question, to the answer, he got gibberish. Recently declassified National Security Archive documents show that U.S. inspectors who were given a partial tour of the Dimona facility in 1962 felt they were being tricked and misled because they're only being shown some of the buildings. It's actually worse than that. Israel built false control rooms to take the inspectors to so they should examine those. And despite the threats from the JFK administration to end support for Israel, Israel never agreed, has never agreed, to IAEA inspections, and ultimately is assumed became a nuclear power, but who are we to say? Kennedy did become the first president to openly sell arms to Israel. Hawk surface-to-air missiles in 1963, although the U.S. did not become Israel's main supplier of weapons until after the Six-Day War. It still remained France up to the war. And to sell those Hawk missiles, Kennedy had to overrule his State Department and the Pentagon, who were opposed because they did not want to antagonize the Arabs. And Kennedy also took an interest in the plight of Soviet Jewry, criticizing the Soviets for shutting down shuls and even raising the issue with Khrushchev when they met, when his friend Louis Weinstein, who was then head of the Conference of Presidents, was rebuffed by the State Department. They said protests would make it worse for the Jews. Weinstein went to JFK, told him that no president since Teddy Roosevelt had intervened on behalf of Russian Jews. Remember Roosevelt after the massacre in Kishinev. JFK responded, well, here's one president who's ready to do something. He asked Weinstein to arrange a public conference in Washington. Unfortunately, 1 week later, JFK was assassinated. And that event was a defining moment in American history. The shockwaves from that Friday afternoon, November 22nd, 1963, still reverberate. There's still a debate until today. Who killed JFK? I know it sounds ghoulish, but as a young child, I read both volumes of the Warren Commission report. My parents had both in the house, and filled with the reports and the pictures and the diagrams, and some of it's gruesome. I was a small child at the time. I also visited the scene twice, the Texas School Book Depository, even walked the grassy knoll, stood at the window from which Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly shot the president. What's my opinion? Can a rabbi have an opinion on this? Yeah, so my opinion is that Oswald murdered Kennedy, operating on his own. After all, he was a marksman. I think part of the denial stems from the psychological need to have a great man murdered by someone great and not a decrepit loser like Oswald. You almost hope there's some grand conspiracy that involves sophisticated, intelligent people for some grand cause. But the truth is, of the four assassins who killed American presidents, three really were disgruntled losers. And the other one who was successful, who really was a political assassin, was John Wilkes Booth, Lincoln. The others were just, losers, unfortunate people. So it was not to be. But everyone agrees that an aggrieved Jew, Jack Ruby, murdered Oswald just a day or two later. Ruby was convicted of murder, sentenced to death, had the conviction overturned, why, don't know. But before a new trial could take place, he died of cancer in 1967, and a lot of secrets died with him as well. Of course, because Ruby had underworld ties, as did JFK, the mafia were suspects, as were the Soviets, as were the Cubans, as was LBJ, and the Jew haters, as is typical, the Mossad. The Mossad was blamed as well. JFK developed such a high opinion of Jews that he saw them as role models. You know, Nixon became infamous for the white, for the Oval Office taping system, but Kennedy used it extensively, and this only came out a decade or two after Nixon's tapes had to be revealed. The day of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, Kennedy welcomed some civil rights leaders into his office, although not King, and he lamented that blacks could not do more for themselves. And he said, and it's disjointed because it's not a speech, it's conversation. Kennedy, now, isn't it possible for the Negro community to take the lead in committing major emphasis upon the responsibility of these families, even if they're split and all the rest of the problems they have on educating their children? In my opinion, the Jewish community, which suffered a good deal under discrimination, and what a great effort they made, which I think has made their role influential, was in education, education of their children. And therefore, they've been able to establish a pretty strong position for themselves. And he concluded to this group, with all the influence that you gentlemen have in the Negro community, you really have to concentrate on what I think the Jewish community has done on educating. Kennedy was 46 when he died, so he's eternally young. Next year, May 29th, 2017, will mark 100 years since his birth. Both his younger brothers, Bobby and Ted, would serve in the Senate and be outspoken supporters of Israel. Both would meet different but tragic fates. Well, JFK was succeeded by Lyndon Baines Johnson, who had yearned to be president for at least a decade, hated JFK, despised RFK, and was often humiliated as vice president, intentionally closed out of any policy or political discussions. It bothered him no end that his administration was always seen as living in JFK's shadow. And when he tried to emerge from that shadow, that's when he ran into problems. And one reason why he increased America's military commitment to Vietnam was that he did not want to be portrayed as a coward by the Kennedys, because John Kennedy had first sent troops there. To me, I think everyone here remembers him, to me he always looked old. And not just because I was very young then, he just looked old, a craggy, lined face. But he was only 55 when he became president, and he died at 64, so he really wasn't that old. It was Johnson, more than any other president not named Roosevelt, who created the welfare state in the guise of what he would call the Great Society. Jews, usually more kind-hearted than politically astute, loved him for it. Even the beneficiaries loved him, and that love has been hard to shake until today. But, truth be told, it was the Great Society that created generations of welfare dependents, multi-generational welfare families, living off government handouts, living in government projects riddled with crime and family dysfunction, including the decline of marriage, the rise of out-of-wedlock births, absentee fathers. In fact, welfare substituted for the disappearance in the family of the male breadwinner, and a complete failure to end what was a very reasonable and moral quest to end poverty in America. Now, for sure, Johnson was greatly troubled by poverty, as he had experienced it as a child and had seen it firsthand in Texas, but the methods he used exacerbated the problem, and the war on poverty failed. The Heritage Foundation issued a report 2 years ago on the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty. Since 1964, when it was launched, the U.S. has spent $22 trillion. I repeat, $22 trillion on anti-poverty program. To put it in perspective, that's more money than has been spent on all of America's wars since the Revolution, adjusted for inflation. and the rate of poverty is still unchanged. 50 years later, it's still 13-14%. We'll get back to that a little later. Lyndon Baines Johnson was born August 27th, 1908, near Stonewall, Texas. His town had no paved roads, no indoor plumbing. It was a two-day journey on unpaved roads to the nearest city, Austin, Texas. His father, Sam, was a state legislator. It was a part-time job, but he could not make a living. His mother, Rebecca, was a cold, critical individual whose love was conditional and quickly withdrawn when she felt disappointed. And no doubt this played a role in how he dealt with people as well. He got two things from his father: a love of alcohol, he was a heavy drinker, and height. LBJ was almost 6'4", making him the second tallest president, if you're keeping score, just a shade, I think 2 centimeters shorter than Abe Lincoln. As is the case with presidents that Jews like, Jewish connections are sought and treasured, if not exaggerated. So too with LBJ. So there are reports out there that Rebecca Baines, his mother's maternal grandparents, were Jews named Huffman, who came from Germany in the mid-19th century, found their way to Texas, mother to his mother, and that makes LBJ Jewish according to Jewish law. Well, it can't be verified. I mean, Huffman's a German name, doesn't mean they're Jewish. What's more credible and verifiable is that Johnson had an aunt, Jessie Johnson Hatcher, who loved Jews. As strange as it sounds, she was a longtime member, I mean over 50 years, of the Zionist Organization of America, and she had a strong influence on LBJ, the child. Both his father and grandfather appealed for clemency for Leo Frank, and Johnson himself, as soon as he joined Congress in 1937, became an outspoken supporter of increased immigration for Jews. And it's estimated, think about this, because it's not widely known, it's estimated that Lyndon Johnson personally saved between 400 to 500 Jews from Europe, acquiring visas for them and having them immigrate to the U.S. through Galveston, Texas. He visited Dachau a month after the war ended, and his wife later wrote, he returned shaken, stunned, terrorized, bursting with revulsion. According to these reports, he later raised money privately to purchase arms for the Haganah pre-state. In other words, it would seem that Lyndon Johnson did much more than most American Jews did at that time. Who knows? But if it's true, it speaks very well of him. Growing up, he became comfortable around politicians, very ambitious. Father was the state legislator for several years. At his mother's urging, he attended Southwest Texas State Teachers College. Harvard it was not. But there he made contacts. He edited the college newspaper, and in that capacity, he attended the 1928 Democrat National Convention in Houston, where Al Smith was nominated. He even took a year off from college, his senior year, to teach school in a dirt poor section of Texas. He needed the money to pay his tuition, and he taught poor Mexican immigrants, and he saw there real poverty and hunger, children rummaging through garbage for grapefruit rinds and the like, and that made a lifelong impression on him. After graduation, he befriended and went to work for wealthy Texan Richard Kleeberg, who was elected to Congress. And LBJ moved to Washington around 1930, 1931, and really never left. He became Kleeberg's secretary, in due course, meeting and befriending, in a cloying sort of way, Sam Rayburn, who became LBJ's mentor and later a father figure, later Speaker of the House. He even met FDR, and FDR was very impressed by Johnson, and after falling out with Kleeberg, Roosevelt appointed Johnson head of the National Youth Administration Office in Texas, where Johnson was very successful. He's a great administrator, very organized, very efficient, and in his position, he created thousands of jobs for Texas youth during the Depression at government expense. In 1934, he married Claudia Taylor, nicknamed Lady Bird, as a child, and so they shared the same initials, LBJ. They gave those same initials to their daughters, Linda Bird, Lucy Baines, a bit of an obsession, one would think. She was from a wealthy family, like he was not, and it was her money that enabled them to live. And he was not so easy to live with. He was completely dedicated to his career, as was she. In the 1930s, he used her money to buy a radio station and then start a television station in Austin. And listen to this, he maneuvered the FCC into allowing them to choose the best programs from the three networks. You think about it, before cable, he had ABC, NBC, CBS, and small towns just had one station. If you're an ABC station, those are the shows. He got special permission to take the most popular shows from each network and show them on his Austin television station, and they made millions from it. And it enabled them to buy the LBJ Ranch near Austin. Has to be said, LBJ, like JFK, was a serial adulterer. JFK by the hundreds, using the Secret Service to bring women in and out of the White House, and Johnson by the dozens, some going back to the 1930s, long-term relationships, and most of them unhidden. His wife, Lady Bird, and how's this for an enabler? I quote, "Lyndon loved people. It will be unnatural for him to withhold love from half the people." All right, they don't make many women like that. In her defense, she had seen her father act in similar ways and just assumed this is the way men were. Kennedy's philandering arguably was a national security problem because he canoodled with, among others, the mistress of a mafia don, as well as an East German spy. Johnson's was more ordinary, if equally disgraceful. Among his paramours, because everything comes together, among his paramours was Helen Gehagen Douglas, who was defeated in a Senate race in 1960 by Richard Nixon. Neither man had any sense of boundaries or propriety when it came to women. And although Kennedy had an upper-class manner about him that people respected, Johnson was often profane, crude, uncouth, did things that I can't speak about in shul, even outside of shul. Malochot kvodo, you can't say these things. In the spirit of the times, he, like Kennedy, were shielded by the media. Said one Secret Service agent about Johnson, if he weren't president, he would be in an insane asylum. His favorite non-alcohol drink? Fresca. All right, not bad. Johnson was elected to the House in 1937. He lost the race for the Senate in 1941, lost the primary to a seasoned opponent who controlled the votes in a number of counties and trotted out those ballots a few days after the election to win a narrow victory, meaning the counties under their control, they would keep ballots with their name on it, and as much as they needed, they would say, "All right, now we won." It was a trick that Johnson learned well and he would use in his next race. In the interim, in Congress, he voted for the draft, enlisted himself, served mostly in the Naval Reserve during World War II in doing administrative work, but he did fly in one combat mission against the Japanese in which his plane was riddled with bullets and almost shot down. General MacArthur, who had been befriended by LBJ, and he had a way of ingratiating himself to powerful people, awarded Johnson the Silver Star. MacArthur saw Johnson as a conduit to Roosevelt. He awarded Johnson the Silver Star, even though he was just the passenger. The actual fighting crew received no medals. Sometimes it's, you know, who you know. In 1948, Johnson ran again for the Senate in a close election, so he learned the trick. He produced enough hidden ballots to win by 87 votes. This election was vigorously litigated. For the first time, Johnson called upon a friend, be a lifelong friend, a well-known Washington lawyer, a Jew named Abe Fortas, to bail him out. Abe Fortas, born in Memphis in 1910, graduated Yale Law School, brilliant legal mind, aide to Justice Douglas. Fortas, behind the scenes, it's hard to imagine these things happening today, but maybe they do. Behind the scenes, Fortas appealed to Justice Hugo Black, who favored LBJ because the opponent was a segregationist. Black, on his own, overruled the federal court, granted the victory to Johnson, thenceforth known as Landslide Lyndon, for his 87-vote victory in the primary. In the general election, he trounced his opponent And with all his contacts and his friendship with majority leader Richard Russell, he became very influential. If you think about it, his two mentors in Congress, House and Senate, were Sam Rayburn and Richard Russell. How prominent were they? Well, one House office building is today named the Rayburn Building, and one Senate office building is named the Russell Building. So these were the top people, and he literally attached himself to them. The truth is that Johnson was a master legislator and very effective in Congress. He defined politics as the art of the possible, and he knew what legislation to push, when to compromise, when to cajole, when to threaten, when to sweet talk, and when to push back. He almost single-handedly prevented Eisenhower from imposing sanctions on Israel after the Sinai campaign in 1956, nipping the effort in the bud and publicly challenging Eisenhower. And he was a master at the inside game of politics. He had exquisite timing. He opposed Joe McCarthy, not the beginning, at the right time when it was shifting. He supported Adlai Stevenson at the right time, and he started to see himself as presidential material, as did his aides. Even a serious heart attack in 1955 could not derail him. Johnson was always a heavy smoker and a heavy drinker. After the heart attack, he gave up smoking immediately. This is the way he worked, his influence. He was a leading supporter of NASA in order to counter the Soviets, and so no surprise, the Space Center was based in Houston, Texas, because he was a genius at steering government money to his constituents. So it's always odd, if you think about it, the spacecraft always took off from the coast of Florida, and yet command control is in Houston. Why? Why not in Florida? It's because they get the money, they get the boondoggle that he brought. Johnson hoped for the nomination in 1960, not by actively campaigning, but planning for a contested convention that would turn to him. Even debated JFK one time. He had no chance versus the Kennedy machine. But Kennedy turned him to be the vice president against Bobby Kennedy's wishes, vehement objections, and promises he'd made during the campaign to supporters that his brother would not appoint LBJ, and Johnson accepted. Kennedy hoped that Johnson would help him in the South in two areas: race, LBJ was seen as more conservative, and religion as a hechsher for JFK's Catholicism, and it worked. JFK won much of the South, including Texas, and he won his narrow victory. In the White House, Kennedy treated Johnson with deference, but kept him at a distance, always sending him across the world, bringing him into some discussions, but not others. He had no idea about the Bay of Pigs invasion, no idea about the Cuban Missile Crisis, these things he read in the newspaper like everyone else. When racial tensions escalated in the early 1960s, Vice President Johnson became chair of a committee designed to promote equal opportunity in government hiring. Not much happened, but Kennedy was reluctant until late 1963 to push for any civil rights reform. And Johnson was always Machiavellian in this regard. He opposed segregation and was quite disposed to full equality for blacks, but as Senate Majority Leader, he watered down civil rights legislation in 1957 to make it more palatable to the South, and so as not to endanger his own electoral standing. After all, he was a Southern Senator. After he became President, November 22, 1963, Johnson pushed an expanded Civil Rights Act to capitalize on Kennedy's popularity. Asked by Roy Wilkins, "Where were you in 1957? LBJ replied, "You will recognize the words I'm about to repeat. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last." And he meant that he was now free from political and electoral considerations, and he could do what his heart wanted. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, making illegal discrimination based on race, religion, sex, national origin, ended racial segregation in public places. It won a narrow victory because LBJ, unlike Kennedy, was personally invested in the outcome and outmaneuvered all the legislative gimmicks that opponents, primarily Southern Democrats, used. Johnson knew every trick in the book, and he outmaneuvered them. The next year, Congress passed the Voting Rights Act, 1965, that outlawed discrimination in voting, and finally, after a century, secured the right of blacks to vote, and also promoted the notion, which we suffer from until today, of gerrymandering districts so a certain percentage of minorities could be elected. Lost to history, and it really shouldn't be, is the reality that the Civil Rights Act passed only because of Republican votes and LBJ's appeal to those Republicans. For example, Democrats in the Senate voted 69% to 31% for the bill, but Republicans voted 82 to 18%. In the House, Democrats 63-37, Republicans 80-20. Without overwhelming Republican support, the bill would not have passed cloture. Even the Voting Rights Act passed the Senate 79-18, but Democrats 49-17, Republicans 30-1. So look at the way American political history has unfolded since then. Go figure. The war on poverty was also a populist measure. LBJ promised the poor, I quote, a hand up, not a hand out. But that is not what happened. Poverty is just as intractable, with the only difference being that the American poor today live better than most of the middle class across the world. There's very little hunger in American society. In fact, there's an obesity problem. It's the opposite. Per a 2013 study, 14% of the population remain below the poverty level. But in that group, 80% have air conditioning in their homes, unlike in Europe. Two-thirds have cable TV. Half have personal computers. More than 90% have cars or trucks. So in fact, the rising tide has lifted all boats, even if there's greater income disparity. And it's a shame that more emphasis was not placed on job training, education standards, and promoting strong, stable families. Without that, the cycle of poverty just continues. In fact, that was the subject of Daniel Patrick Moynihan's famous report in 1965, that if you don't heal the crumbling black family, there'll be an underclass la'olam va'ed. 1964, Johnson swept to victory in one of the largest landslides ever, defeating Barry Goldwater. And when the year started, remember, just a little over a month after the assassination, it was not even certain that LBJ would run, much less win. People were clamoring for Bobby Kennedy to run. Johnson feared a Kennedy stampede at the convention. Once he announced, there was widespread pressure to nominate Bobby Kennedy for vice president. Johnson was dead set against it. And Johnson anointed the natural choice, Hubert Humphrey, one of the staunchest pro-Israel advocates the Senate ever had. Jews voted 90-10 for LBJ, a margin that only FDR ever reached, and no one has reached since. But at least that was not far off from the general result. LBJ won 61-39%, an electoral landslide of 486-52. Goldwater won only six southern states. It wasn't soon after the election that Congress approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, and LBJ would become mired in the Vietnam War. Johnson told Jewish leaders who had grown to admire Kennedy when he took office that, I quote, "You have lost a very great friend, but you have found an even better one." Now, LBJ had no Jews in his cabinet until his last year in office, 1968, when he appointed Wilbur Cohn, I never heard of him either, as Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. And Cohn was instrumental expanding Medicaid and Medicare, but he was close to a number of Jews. Abe Feinberg, a longtime supporter, Arthur Krim, he and his wife, he was the head of United Artists, he had Eugene Rostow and his brother Walt, Ben Wattenberg was a speechwriter, he was close as well with Arthur Goldberg. Arthur Goldberg even greeted Johnson at the airport in Washington, November 22nd, 1963. By then, Goldberg was the Supreme Court Justice, and LBJ asked him to think of ways to unite the country. Goldberg was a Chicago native, whose father was born in all places in Auschwitz, then part of Russia, and he served in Army Intelligence during World War II. In the OSS. In 1965, Johnson talked Goldberg into resigning his seat on the Supreme Court, becoming ambassador to the UN, where he too would play a role before, during, and after the Six-Day War. Arthur Goldberg, ignominiously, 1966, two journalists married. It was a big D.C. event. A Jew named Stephen Roberts, reporter for the Times, and a young woman named Cokie Boggs, who became Cokie Roberts, who I'm sure many of you heard of, the daughter of Congressman Hale Boggs. It was a major social event. An intermarriage, the couple could not find a rabbi to co-officiate with the Cokie's priest. Intermarriage then still being rare and opposed by most Jews. So Arthur Goldberg played the role of Jewish presence, reciting some blessings, addressing the couple under their chuppah, Hashem Yerachem. Goldberg's Supreme Court seat was given to Abe Fortas. Abe Fortas served for 3 years until Chief Justice Warren resigned and Johnson nominated Fortas to be the Chief Justice. He would have been the first, my now only, Supreme Court Justice. That nomination was withdrawn when it was revealed that Fortas, from the Supreme Court, had continued to advise LBJ on political matters, even on Vietnam. The liberal Fortas was a hawk. And the next year, Fortas had to resign from the court in disgrace when it was proven that while on the court, had continued to be paid an annual retainer of $20,000 by the Wolfson Foundation as a trustee, even after Lewis Wolfson went to prison for stock manipulation. I will end with the Six-Day War. In 1966, Johnson hosted Zalman Shazar, the president, at the White House. Later that year, the Israelis broached the subject of a military alliance with the U.S. Johnson said a formal alliance was not necessary because the U.S. was always committed to Israel's security. He might have meant it, but it did not happen. When war clouds arrived on the Middle East horizon in May 1967, LBJ was swamped with bad news from Vietnam, was not fully responsive to Israel's needs, and he was a bit annoyed. Most Jews, including erstwhile allies, were by now prominently anti-war, and he took it personally. Rallies across the Arab world called for death to Israel, throw the Jews into the sea. As Arab leaders boasted of the coming conquest, Nasser expelled the UN peacekeepers from Sinai, closed the Straits of Tehran to Israeli shipping, an act of war, and a right that the U.S., as Eisenhower promised in 1957, was supposed to guarantee. Johnson claimed he could find no record of such a guarantee, and he insisted that Israel do nothing. And this is what caused the Hamtana, the long waiting period, May 1967, when Israelis were mobilized, but nothing happened. And Johnson threatened, Israel will not be alone unless it decides to go it alone. He was against Israel launching a preemptive strike. He urged Israel to wait until world diplomacy resolved the Straits of Tehran issue. They would still be waiting. Among Israelis, Ben-Gurion was almost alone in being completely opposed to a preemptive attack. And the administration contained individuals unfriendly to Jews and Israel, names like Ramsey Clark and Dean Rusk, George Ball and others, and some of them were more concerned about not provoking the Soviets than about Israel's existence. And the State Department even urged Israel to absorb an initial attack if such was to come. Bad advice that was again offered in 1973 before the Yom Kippur War, and then Israel listened. In short, LBJ's U.S. was unhelpful to Israel before the Six-Day War, notwithstanding the 90% Jewish vote he had won notwithstanding the 90% vote he had won in 1964. And neither Britain nor France would issue any statement of support for Israel. Israel was alone. Part of the reason Israel attacked June 5th, 1967, was the growing realization that the U.S. would not do anything at all, and that coupled with the escalating threats from several Arab countries induced Levi Eshkol to strike first. And that first strike, destroying the Egyptian Air Force within several hours, set the tone for the war, an Israeli rout on all three fronts, then in a week tripled the size of the country and transformed the Middle East until today. Immediately, the Soviets began seeking a ceasefire. Johnson was lukewarm to the idea at first, as thousands of letters poured into the White House that week, 96% pro-Israel. And indeed, there were some administration voices that privately urged Israel to finish off Nasser once and for all. June 8th, the fourth day of the war, Israel bombed the Liberty, an American spy ship that was off the coast of El Arish. And it's controversial until today. The claim then was that it was mistakenly identified as an Egyptian ship, was accepted by Johnson, even as it seems that Israel targeted the ship because it was interfering with planned Israeli military operations, either in Egypt or in the Golan. That is to say, it was a spy ship. It was spying on Israeli communications, and for all Israel knew, conveying the information to Syria or Egypt. Jew haters have always made much of it, as 34 Americans were killed. I was surprised to learn this myself. A few years ago, I visited the National Cryptologic Museum, which is right outside the NSA headquarters in Fort Meade, Maryland. And of course, the Liberty, they said then it was a supply ship. It was actually a signal intelligence ship, so naturally it's part of this. And I realized that the commander of the Liberty was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for his actions during this incident. Why that would be, it's very hard to understand, but nonetheless he was. And it's a source of bitterness to this day to Jew haters in the American military establishment. The lead Israeli pilot, Yiftach Spector, led the raid against the Iraqi reactor in Baghdad exactly 14 years later, less one day. Now, Israel almost immediately apologized for the Liberty, and over the years paid close to $10 million in damages to the families of the victims. Johnson accepted the apology, and from his perspective, the matter was closed. The diplomacy after the war has influenced events until today, and here LBJ was just as equivocal, not wanting Israel to gain from the war, and at the same time, not wanting to force them back to the old borders. So American diplomats, especially Goldberg and Rostow, with Abba Ibn and others, hammered out the text of UN Resolution 242 that could have been worse. I quote, emphasizing the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war. That's a refrain only applied to Israel. That's the one club used to beat Israel over the head with constantly. Every nation acquires territory by war. Israel can't. And they want to work for a just and lasting peace in which every state in the area can live in security. That actually turned it to Israel's benefit, because it mentioned state. And for a decade and a half, Israel refused to negotiate with the Palestinians because they weren't a state. The conflict called for withdrawal of the resolution called for withdrawal of Israeli armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. And Goldberg was emphatic. The omission of the word from territories, as opposed to from the territories, was intentional. It meant that Israel could withdraw from territories. That is to say, some, but not necessarily all. Of course, that's in the English version. It's not in the French version. There it says day, and it's not in the Arabic version. So that's the argument. This has been fought over now for going on 60 years, with Israel gradually adopting full withdrawal as its desire, even if various governments struggle to carry out that surrender because Arab obstinacy. Only Yerushalayim and the Golan have been formally annexed by Israel. And when the resolution called for negotiations, termination of all claims, etc., it made no mention of a Palestinian state or Palestinians because such did not exist at this time, entering the world diplomatic stage several years later. Even before 242 was adopted in November 1967, the Arab world met in Khartoum, issued its own resolution in September, no peace, no negotiation, no recognition of Israel, period. But in 1968, after protracted negotiations, Johnson approved the sale of Phantom jets to Israel, and the alliance was complete. And from then on, America has become Israel's leading supplier of weapons. Johnson's presidency, to close, had a tragic end. The Vietnam War slogged on. He became even more insulated as staffers turned against the war. The media turned on him. Media portrayed America's victory in the Tet Offensive as a defeat. The media portrayed LBJ's victory in the 1968 New Hampshire primary. He was a writing candidate. He wasn't on the ballot, and he beat McCarthy, Eugene McCarthy, 49-42%. That was another defeat. Now think about it. In the current election season, yeah, guys coming in third place, fourth place, claiming victory. Here he won, and they said it was a defeat. Johnson feared most losing to Bobby Kennedy, and on March 31st, he announced he would not seek another term. Within days, Martin Luther King was killed. 2 months later, Bobby Kennedy was killed, and the country descended into chaos, riots. The Democrat Party split. Richard Nixon defeated Hubert Humphrey and George Wallace in the election. And he didn't live much longer. LBJ died January 22nd, 1973, 2 days after Nixon was inaugurated for his second term. He was 64 years old, and he left office. You could probably understand why, and it's almost clinically verifiable, in a depression. He did not enjoy his last year in office at all. Few presidents have been as admired by liberals for their domestic policy as was LBJ, and few were as loathed for their foreign policy as was LBJ. In a sense, he never escaped Kennedy's shadow, and was a far more successful president than Kennedy was, but you'd never know. Domestically, he realized JFK's policies in a way Kennedy could not, and continue, but also expanded Kennedy's Vietnam policy in a way that protected Kennedy from future criticism. And American culture, morality changed and has not yet recovered. Both Kennedy and Johnson had a fondness for Jews that did not always manifest itself in policy towards Jews or to Israel. Next time we'll discuss Nixon and Ford. It was Richard Nixon, who really had no love for Jews at all, who nonetheless turned out to be one of Israel's greatest protectors at a time of great need as well. I thank you all very much.